Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today. News, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is Walter B. Levis, author of The Meaning of the Murder. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the hosts and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The Druze people in Syria have been much in the news this past week, and the Israeli Air Force got involved, and all of that requires, well, a lot of explanation. First of all, Syria is in the midst of an almost eternal violent civil war. The provisional government that overthrew the horrible Assad regime is trying to control a fractious country. It is apparently doing so in part by slaughtering lots of people, including the Alawite minority that used to be in power, and recently the Druze. Syria has been a country for many, many centuries, unlike, say, neighboring Jordan or Iraq, both of which were created out of whole cloth following the collapse of the British Empire in the 20th century. But Syria is far from being a homogeneous nation of Sunni Muslim Arabs. They do form the largest part of its population, but Syria also includes a variety of minorities, both religious and ethnic. The Assad regime was drawn from the Alawites, a Shia Muslim sect composing a little more than 10% of the Syrian population, but which ruled the nation with an iron fist and great brutality for over 50 years. There are many other divisions in the complicated population map of Syria. The Arab-Sunni majority, but also ethnic and tribal divides between Bedouins and city people in Damascus and Aleppo, and of course the Bedouins and the Druze, Assyrians in the east, ethnic Arameans who speak two different variations of that ancient language, a large and powerful minority population of Kurds, smaller but still significant populations of Turks, Armenian Christians, and Syrian Orthodox Christians, as well as Muslim sects like these Shia Alawites, of course. All of these groups are at times pitted against one another or in the crosshairs of the government and military of Syria itself. There's even a pretty serious rivalry between the major urban areas of Damascus and Aleppo. To illustrate this, the venerable Jewish community of Syria, once tens of thousands strong, now mostly located in Israel, the U.S., and France, and down to perhaps 200 Jews, but the so-called Syrian Jewish community is never truly made up of Syrian Jews. They are either Aleppo Jews or Damascus Jews. Never the twain shall meet. They each maintain different synagogues. I've been in both, and they're a little different. Syria is composed of many minorities and rivalries, and it was held together under the Ba'ath regime of Assad by brute force and ruthless cruelty. Now, during the awful period when the Islamic State of ISIS controlled large swaths of Syria and Iraq and nearly toppled the Assad regime and incorporated all of Syria into the Islamist caliphate, that was only fully stopped in 2017, if you remember, by Russian military action, Iranian troops, and the Kurds with U.S. air support, quite an interesting coalition. Anyway, all minority groups during the time of ISIS were attacked indiscriminately with awful casualties. Many Syrians fled the country. There are currently something like 6 million Syrian refugees living abroad, most in Turkey, who fled the Islamic State or the Assad regime or simply the fact of civil war and haven't yet been able to go home. That civil war dates back not to the last year, but all the way back to 2011. In fact, I remember leading a mission trip to Israel back in 2014, standing on the Golan Heights with my group, looking down at Quneitra, which is in Syria. We could see puffs of smoke from the guns of two groups fighting for control of the town in that year's version of the Syrian Civil War. In addition to all this internal strife, since the founding of Israel in 1948, Syria has been in a perpetual state of war against the Jewish state. Syria tried to destroy Israel in wars in 1948, in 1967, and in 1973, eventually failing dismally each time, but fighting hard and inflicting many Israeli casualties. The Syrian border has never been a peaceful place. Even after ceasefires, the Ba'ath regime in Syria, which is, it was in place more than 50 years, was never interested in a peace treaty with Israel. Unlike Egypt, which has had a durable peace treaty with Israel since Jimmy Carter's presidency, Syria has remained hostile to Israel, technically at war. At the height of the Oslo process, when peace treaties were signed with Jordan and the Palestinian Authority, Syria refused to come on board. Before 1967, and again in 1973, the Syrian side of the Golan Heights was used to shell Israeli kibbutzim and moshavim, and to offer a refuge and training site and launch pad for terrorist attacks on Israelis. In recent years, Syria has been a pathway for the transit of rockets and other weapons and weapons systems to the Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon. Iranian troops and rockets were stationed on the western side of Syria and the Syrian parts of the Golan Heights to harass and threaten Israel until just last year. Now, in these same Golan Heights and in suburbs of Damascus, among other places, one of the most interesting and effective minority groups in this very complicated, polyglot, ethnically mixed country of Syria is the Druze. They are a fascinating religious and ethnic group indeed. The Druze religion began 1,000 years ago in the 11th century as an offshoot of a mystical branch of Islam, Ismaili Islam, but soon the Druze turned away from Islam, developed their own religion. The Druze religion, strictly monotheistic, does not recognize Muhammad as a prophet. The Druze have their own sacred scriptures, which are kept secret, and their own shrines. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law in the Torah, is their most prominent prophet. I visited his shrine back in 2015, about 10 years ago, in Israel, near Hittin, site of a crucial medieval battle, the Horns of Hattin, in which the Crusaders were essentially destroyed by Saladin. The Druze are a unique ethno-religious group. They allow neither conversion into being Druze nor conversion out of being Druze. There are substantial numbers of Druze living in Lebanon and Israel, close to 200,000 in each country, and there are 650,000 in Syria. The Druze policy has always been this. The Druze are loyal residents of whatever nation controls their territory. They fight in its armies. They don't seek to have their own nation. The Druze in Israel are highly respected for their service in the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, and some have served in the Knesset. I interviewed a Druze MK here on Too Jewish some years back. The Druze in Lebanon, similarly loyal and martial, serve in the Lebanese military and were some of the toughest opponents of Israeli troops in the Lebanon War in the 1980s and during Israel's occupation of parts of southern Lebanon some decades back. Now, the Druze in Syria are an important minority, a very important minority, in spite of making up just 2.5% of the overall population of 25 million Syrians. In Syrian history, back in the 20th century, the Druze, tightly organized and strong fighters, at times have even been perceived as a serious threat to the regime. What's going on now is that the provisional government's forces have been attacking the Druze. We aren't totally sure why. They also have permitted the Druze to visit relatives in Israel for the first time since 1948. This new government has allowed them to make pilgrimages to the tomb of Jethro, but apparently, certainly among the Bedouin in Syria, the Druze are perceived as a danger to the new government or something, and they were being wantonly attacked and civilians were being murdered and slaughtered. To prevent an apparent effort at the genocide of the Druze, the Israeli Air Force carried out a series of powerful airstrikes on the Syrian military headquarters in Damascus and on the troops who were attacking the Druze. In response, the Syrian army pulled back from slaughtering Druze and, at least for now, has left the Druze areas. So why does Jewish Israel care about the potential genocide of the Druze, a totally different religious and ethnic group? Well, first, because there are close to 200,000 Druze living in Israel, considered loyal voting citizens who serve in the IDF, are highly respected by Israelis, have many relatives whose lives are being endangered or ended by the Syrians. Secondly, Israel is sensitive about borders, and the Syrian army attacking the Druze nearly on the border with Israel raised many concerns. In this day and age, it is, to say the least, unusual to see a sovereign nation actually prevent a genocide. That's what Israel's been doing. Mind you, the idiots who claim Israel's perpetrating genocide in Gaza clearly don't understand the meaning of the word. In the midst of brutal urban warfare over the last 21 months, more than 600 days in an area of 2 million people, the fact that 15,000 civilians have been killed, some by Hamas terrorists, some by Israeli fire, is in fact a stunningly low number. The number of 50,000 that's cited by the Hamas-Palestinian terrorists includes their own fighters, that is, terrorists. The number of civilians is, of course, much lower. It is sad that perhaps 15,000 civilians have died. It is tragic, but it is far from genocide. Mind you, in the Syrian civil war still ongoing, 650,000 people have died overall, and most of them were civilians. So, my friends, that's why Israel bombed Syrian military targets last week, in order to protect the Druze from a genocide at the hands of the Syrian army. It seems, for the moment, to be working. If you aren't sure whether this was the right thing for Israel to do, all you need to know is that Russia, under the brutal dictator Tsar Putin, condemned the Israeli strikes. Well, that definitely tells you they were both justified and probably essential. We hope that the high level of tension on the Syrian border eases soon. There remains hope that the new regime in Syria of al-Shara, focused on internal problems and finding the problems of the past and fixing them, will create a positive relationship with Israel. The rhetoric has certainly been much tamer than it used to be. It would, however, help everything if this new government of Syria stopped trying to slaughter its own people, especially now the Druze. While we are on the subject of Syria, one of my favorite synagogues in the whole world to attend services in is Addis Synagogue, the Halabi Temple in Jerusalem. That is, the congregation of Jews who immigrated from Aleppo, Syria to Israel. Many came in the early 20th century, fleeing persecution and riots in Syria, finding a safe haven in the eternal Jewish homeland. Their melodies and some of their texts are unique. Everyone in the congregation sings all the pizmonim, all the liturgical songs together throughout the service. And so to play us in this morning, here's Soma Nafshi from the Aleppo musical tradition, My Soul Thirsts for God.
Yisrael Israel, Eretz Tzevi. Yisrael, am bahar lo, Yivnei lahem, Eretz Tzevi.
That was Soma Nafshi, My Soul Thirsts for You, God, from the Jews of Aleppo, Syria. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is award-winning author Walter B. Levis, author of the new book, The Meaning of the Murderer. Find out whose murder and why it's a Jewish book when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Walter B. Levis is the author of a new book, The Meaning of the Murder, a novel. He's a former crime reporter. Articles have appeared in, kind of everywhere, New York Daily News, The New Republic, National Law Journal. He is also the author of a previous novel, Moments of Doubt, and his short stories have appeared in a number of publications and received a variety of prizes. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, okay, what's the meaning of the murder?
Well, that's the question, right. The book tells a story of a family that has gotten unwittingly caught up in the global war on terror.
Right.
Father of this family is a bank compliance officer. These are the years just after the 9/11 and previously the World Trade Center attacks, when bank compliance became a major tool in the war against terror by the institution of the OFAC laws, and the idea was to go after terrorism by looking at the funding.
Yeah, stopping, follow the money, basically, and stop the money flow, right?
Exactly. So the father finds his bank is, in fact, supporting terrorist organizations. The short version of this is he brings it to the top brass of the bank, and they tell him to strip the payments and to ignore this. They're making a lot of money. And he then turns whistleblower and goes to the State Department against his bank. And then just before he's supposed to testify, he disappears. The story then picks up with many years later when his family is still reeling from the loss of this. It's a cold case. And one of his daughters has become an NYPD detective and is determined to try and find out what has happened to her father, which she eventually does find out as the story unfolds.
I'll tell you, the level of, how can I describe this? I mean, there's a quality of the procedural here, but there's a grit to this book that I don't think you find too often, even in crime novels. Feels like you know kind of all the ins and outs of all of this. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, I appreciate hearing that. It's important to me because, I was a crime reporter for years. I have many good friends in the law enforcement and the military world, and their willingness to be open with me on the condition of anonymity, frankly, but their willingness to be open with me and talk to me about it, and I got access to information and things that was really a privilege to get to learn about. I also am glad to hear you responding to the sort of veracity and authenticity, because part of my conviction is that the story of what it's like to be a law enforcement and to be on the military side of things, the story of that is complicated, ambiguous, and hard to tell. There's a cartoon quality to much of what we see in the popular culture about, you know, the cops are this, cops are that, military people are this, military people are that. I'm actually interested in trying to create a more nuanced and complicated picture of what it's like for law enforcement and the military people who are tasked with this idea of fighting terrorism. It's a complicated...
It certainly feels that way. We'll talk much more with Walter B. Levis about the meaning of the murder, his novel, and about the war on terrorism, and about how Orthodox Judaism plays an important part in his book. When we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established almost 7 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. We have a really fun event coming up, a night of musical improv, kosher deli, and treif improvisation. It'll be at the Unscrewed Theater on Sunday, August 3rd at 6 p.m., with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, joining there from the top players in my first ever improvisational experience. We'll find out how it goes. Should be a lot of fun. Go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org, to sign up. Join us also in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to the website, beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Call 520-276-5675. Religious School is registering now for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our Torah Tikes program for the youngest kids, Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org to sign up. Our services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat with homemade challah. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. with Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m. with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can also go to all of our services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. Our musical service are in person and by virtual experience, and all of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. We have a wonderful series of classes, including Hebrew, the fastest way to learn Hebrew, and introductory Judaism, and lots of other stuff. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our August 3rd musical night of improv, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Beit Simcha Tucson. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments are a big help.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Good morning, Rabbi.
So after that fulsome introduction, Turkey is in a unique position, I think, in the whole time I've been, the whole time we've been talking about Turkey over to Jewish, 20-some years we've been talking about it, in that Iran has diminished significantly and Turkey has always seen itself as the leader of the Muslim world. It has also historically had a pretty good relationship with Israel. That is decaying, and it has had a Jewish population of significance going back at very least to the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. It's complicated. Let's set the scene a little bit.
All righty. It's very complicated. It's a country that I know well, or at least knew well until COVID hit, basically. I haven't been there since. So any of my comments and observations are a little bit dated. But some things are eternal. And one is what you mentioned, Turkey seeing itself as a leader of the Muslim world. So there are actually three sort of centers of political, intellectual power, cultural power in the Islamic world. One is the Arab world, which is Arabic speaking and extends from Morocco and Mauritania in West Africa all the way through to Iraq on the eastern edge. Just east of that is Iran and the Persian-speaking world, which is, loosely speaking, Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. The other stans in Central Asia all speak Turkic languages, and Turkic language, culture, politics, etc., were always one of the three principal players in intra-Islamic politics. Historically, the capital was, of course, Constantinople, which then changed names to Istanbul, but now it's Ankara. So you will sometimes read or hear in the news, Ankara says this, or Ankara's position is that. That's a reference to the fact that Ankara, which most people have never visited or heard of, is in fact the capital of modern Turkey. Arabic, Persian, Turkic.
Right.
And the Turkic world goes all the way to like Lake Baikal in eastern Russia. There are regions of China, like Uyghuristan, all of western China, which is full of minority people called Uyghurs.
Yeah, the Uyghurs who are Muslim Turks, basically. I mean, Turkic peoples.
Right. They are Turkic-speaking peoples. They're definitely part of the Turkic world and the leader of the resistance. Or the pro-autonomy movement of Uyghurs resides in Turkey. So they see themselves very much as being part of a world that extends from the border between China and Kazakhstan all the way to the border between Turkey and Bulgaria. And to be fair and accurate, for historic reasons, many of the countries in the Balkans have at least a small Turkish minority. In one country, Bulgaria, has a significant Turkish-speaking minority and even a Turkic party in parliament. So Turkey goes way beyond its borders. So does Iran. And so does the Arab world, where these days the capital is Riyadh. But historically and intellectually, the capital was Cairo, which had the big universities, and it was definitely the cultural center of the Arab world for many centuries. But that swath of territory with which we're all familiar is the Arab world, and people often confuse Arabs and Muslims. So I hope this helps at least dispel that confusion.
One would hope, you know, it's funny, people think all Muslims are Arabs, and then you go to like Indonesia, let alone the Middle East. But clearly, Turks and Iranians are not Arabs, and they're also Muslim, by and large. Tom, we will continue this discussion next week because it's, I think it's important and it's complicated and sort of see what's going on in Turkey nowadays.
Right. I look forward to that.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Leah has been married for only 2 months when she has her first big fight with her husband. Immediately after, she goes to see the rabbi. "Hello, Leah. Nice to see you," says Rabbi Levy. "It seems only yesterday I married you and Arnold under the chuppah. How are you both doing?" "That's why I'm here, Rabbi," Leah replies, crying. "Arnold and I had an awful fight, just awful." "Don't cry," says Rabbi Levy. "This often happens soon in a marriage." "Please don't cry," says Rabbi Levy. "This often happens early in a marriage. Please calm down. I think every marriage has to have its first fight sometime." "I know that, Rabbi," says Leah. "But what am I going to do with Arnold's body?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, the last sections of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Both portions teach an important message about the centrality of Jewish family values, but they do so in very different ways. The setting for these final parshiot in Numbers is the border of the Promised Land. The Israelites are approaching Canaan for the second time after a 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of the tribes, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. They say, "We like the land we're traveling through now, right here." That is the east bank of the Jordan in what is today the country of Jordan, long before the Arab peoples moved into the Middle East. The leaders of Reuben and Gad say, "Let us stay here and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children." Moses agrees, but in interesting language. First, he tells them, "Build towns for your children and then build sheepfolds for your flocks." The message is pretty clear. Family comes first, our professions and income second. It's a human message, one we need to relearn in every generation, sometimes multiple times. Put family first. And then in the very last section of the book of Numbers, Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created called the City of Refuge, the Ir Miklat. In the days before police forces and criminal courts, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. Vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by a killing. If you killed somebody, intentionally or accidentally, even if the family of a person who was killed just thought you'd committed a killing, you would likely be killed in turn by their kinsmen. That meant that if you were involved in this kind of terrible situation, you had very little chance to remain alive, even if the killing was accidental. In fact, even if you were completely innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, it wouldn't help. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to cycles of revenge. the sort of blood feuds Mark Twain described about the Hatfields and McCoys several millennia later, the kind of clan murder revenge cycles that take place even today in Palestinian Arab towns in the West Bank, in Syria and Lebanon. To preclude this sort of social disaster, the Torah portion of Maaseh provides for six cities of refuge in and around the land of Israel. No person entering these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the city of refuge itself is a kind of protection, the guarantee of due process, what has become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history. And yet the Torah established that principle over 3,000 years ago. Whether it did so to protect innocents accused of murder, or simply to keep families from falling into cycles of revenge and murder, we don't know. But we do know. The Torah teaches us, in this quite different way, that the most basic unit of society, the family, must be nurtured, maintained, and protected. Its positive values strengthened, even in the most trying of situations. A great message still. When we return in a moment, our guest, Walter B. Leavis, award-winning author and journalist, explains how he made certain that his new novel had the right gritty feel and just why Judaism is so central to it. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Tucker Carlson, the former Fox News host and a leader in the Republican Party's isolationist wing, said Americans who previously served in the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, should have their U.S. citizenship revoked over concerns of, quote-unquote, dual loyalty. In the same speech, he criticized the Trump administration for trying to deport pro-Palestinian students engaging in anti-Israel and anti-Semitic activity on campus. There are a lot of Americans who served in the IDF. They should lose their citizenship, Tucker Carlson said during a 45-minute speech last week at the Turning Point USA Student Action Summit in Tampa, Florida. You can't fight for another country and remain an American, period. Carlson has also promoted anti-Semitic tropes. He has long been associated with white nationalists. He explained that his position is an obvious recognition of the truth and applies to all countries. Tucker Carlson mocked his critics. They just write you off as some sort of internet freak, hater, Nazi. Imagine that. Thinking a guy espousing anti-Semitic views and virulent ones and white racist supremacist ideas is a Nazi? How could anybody think that about Tucker Carlson? And then he said, "It is fair to demand that the people running my country love it every bit as much as I do." The founder of the organization Carlson spoke to is Charlie Kirk, a conservative podcaster who has accused the Jews of financing anti-white causes. Several Trump cabinet members and Republican officials attended and spoke at the three-day conference. In a Q&A session after his remarks, Carlson also agreed with an audience member that the Trump administration's crackdown and deportation of pro-Palestinian students engaging in anti-Israel activity and violence is totally outrageous. You got 65 million people here illegally, according to the administration. Boy, those are bizarre numbers. And the only ones deported are ones who criticized a foreign country, Carlson claimed, full of lies. I don't understand it. It's driving people insane, actually. It's making people angry in a bad way. The Trump administration, in fact, has engaged in sweeping immigration raids in recent months and deported many people. But Carlson highlighted only those arrested for pro-Palestinian terrorist activities. Carlson also devoted about half of his speech to a government memo released last week related to the Jeffrey Epstein scandal that has embroiled the Trump administration and caused division within the MAGA base in recent days. Carlson claimed that Epstein, a disgraced Jewish financier accused of sex trafficking, was working for the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service. "It's extremely obvious to anyone who watches that this guy had direct connections to a foreign government," Tucker Carlson just blathered. No one is allowed to say that the foreign government is Israel because we've been somehow cowed into thinking that that's naughty. There's nothing wrong with saying that. There's nothing hateful about saying that. There's nothing anti-Semitic about saying that. There's nothing even anti-Israel about saying that. And there's nothing, by the way, Tucker, true about that. In other news, when Israeli strikes hit Iran June 13th, it wasn't only nuclear sites and senior Iranian commanders that were taken out. A covert army of bots meddling in English politics went dark, too. That's according to Siabra, a Tel Aviv-based disinformation detective company that uncovered the British operation. For 16 days, the Iranian network, which began operating in May, vanished, according to Siabra's report last week. No posts, no replies, no trace of 1,300 fake profiles that had posed as British users and fueled online debate around Scottish independence, Brexit, and institutional collapse. The accounts had reached more than 200 people through over 3,000 posts, the cybersecurity company said. When the network returned after Iranian communication was restored, the tone had changed. The same AI-generated personas that previously blended into UK political discourse now were sharing pro-Iranian content and ridiculing Western leaders. Siabra analysts said that the 16-day gap offered a rare before-and-after snapshot of direct, time-linked evidence of state-sponsored interference online. The sudden disruption in Iran's influence operations capabilities due to the war with Israel exposed the whole operation, said Dan Brahmi, Siabra's CEO. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, author Walter B. Levis, is the author of The Meaning of the Murder, a really powerful, sharp, tightly, tautly created novel about the fight against international terrorism, among many other things, and one family's response. Prominent crime reporter, author of a previous novel and a number of short stories. So, what was the most difficult thing for you in putting The Meaning of the Murder together?
I think the most difficult thing from the standpoint of the craft is that for all its geopolitical backdrop, I'm trying to tell an intimate story. Yes, there's this tremendous weight of the war on terror that hangs over the book, but ultimately it's about love. This is about a father and a daughter. Sisters who are bound together by law. There's a husband and a wife trying to hold on to each other in the face of terrible fear and doubt. And I'm trying to explore how, you know, love endures not as like a shield against violence, but almost as a reason to keep going in the midst of violence. And blending these two stories was a difficult thing from a craft standpoint. The police procedural has a lot of kind of expectations in it. And the truth is I had difficulty publishing the book because commercial publishers felt that, is this a crime book or a family book?
Right.
And the hybrid nature of that is really what I was interested in and why I'm so pleased to have this out there now.
This is a very tough book in a lot of ways. It's got child abusers. It's got all kinds of stuff in there. In writing about that, how do you balance those kinds of themes?
Well, you know, one answer to how to balance that would be the title of the book, The Meaning of the Murder, comes directly from the epigraph that opens the book, which is a passage from Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Right.
And of course, Frankl, who survived Auschwitz, you know, he published this book in 1946. It's been an important book to me. I first read it in college. I returned to it after 9/11. I read it again during the pandemic. And each time this book struck a deeper chord. So, you know, how to balance these different meanings of the book is partly, look, the popular takeaway from Frankl's book is often, you know, sort of simplified to be, well, meaning can be found even in the face of suffering. But I think there's a much more subtle insight in Frankl's book, which is that we shouldn't really ask, you know, what the meaning of life is. We should recognize that life is asking us And that meaning isn't something, you know, abstract to be discovered. It's something, you know, we answer for. And in this book, I'm trying to ask what this is like for this, you know, modern Orthodox Jewish family living an observant life. And suddenly they are caught in this. And the sisters in particular, after their father disappears, are struck with what is this going to mean to them? And what's their personal response to it? And this idea that meaning is personal, it's situational, and it's inescapably moral. This is, I think, part of what I've been trying to balance in looking at both a large political question and a very intimate personal family matter.
Who's your favorite character in the book?
Well, that's an interesting question. Who's my favorite character in the book? Well, I mean, in some ways, for me, writing is something that sort of happens. You know, you start with something and then, you know, before you know it, it's like having a conversation with someone. It takes turns that you don't expect it to take, you know. So in getting to know these characters, I sort of fell in love with all of them because otherwise I don't think you care enough to sit alone in the room and write the rest of the book. But in many ways, the main character, Eliana, who's, you know, a female Jewish detective, and all of these characters are a composite of many, many people who I know and have spoken to. You know, she's the character who undergoes an enormous transformation by pursuing the leads on what happened to her father and coming to understand it in a different kind of way. But I also care a lot about her sisters. And frankly, you know, there is a character who is a military guy, and he is bound by his sense of duty to do his work. And he's also very, very conflicted about the price he pays for being willing to kill and to do the horrible things that war involves. So I actually had a deep, deep feeling for him as well.
In your work as a crime reporter, how often did you have to deal with questions of international terrorism?
In my work as a crime reporter, I only dealt with the financial side of the real questions of international terrorism. My work as a crime reporter was much more grounded in literally what we used to call the police blotter. You know, you go and you see what crimes have happened where and when, and you go talk to people and the victims and the investigating detectives, et cetera, et cetera. But part of what interests me is the way we try to think about crime as one thing and political violence as something else. Terrorism blurs those boundaries in an interesting kind of way. And that also is partly what got me very animated in writing this novel. Street crime and political violence are related but different. And that intersection is, I find, interesting and compelling and troubling, frankly.
Do you think there's an American obsession with a connection between love and violence?
Wow, that's a very sensitive question, I think. You know, I don't have a really good, clear answer for that question. In short, I think there is a fascination between the relationship between love and violence. I have one quick anecdote I can tell in relationship to that question. Is I attended a graduation ceremony of the Navy SEALs out in Coronado. And one of the speakers at this graduation, and here's a group of new guys. These are the real deal, the SEALs. They've earned the pin. They're in. They're the real guys. So here's the punchline I'm trying to get to. One of the speakers at the graduation said that he wants to congratulate all the people in the family who are here today because you are all in the Navy. Your love for the soldiers is part of what will allow them to do their job. And then he said something even more striking, I thought, is he said that there are people who believe a good soldier should have no attachments because the attachments are going to make you weak. And what he said is that I believe the opposite, that love will make you a better soldier because you will know what you're fighting for.
So this is a new book. It's out fresh, but it takes a long time to get a book out. What are you working on now?
I am working on a book now that's not completely unrelated. I have a draft written. It's about, I'll give away a little bit of the plot. It's about an interracial relationship. A young African-American woman has fallen in love with her boss, who's a Jewish restaurant owner, and they have made plans to get married. And those plans get interrupted when a very old boyfriend of hers who has been in jail gets out of jail and wants to get back together with his old girlfriend.
So I have to ask you, how does somebody end up a crime reporter?
Well, I was a tennis pro until I was 30 years old. I tried to play a little bit on the circuit and quickly realized I was never going to, you know, make it as a prize money guy. I was a teaching pro, as we call it. But the reason I say this is because when I was 30 years old and I realized I did not want to have my whole career be as a tennis pro, I already had the bug for writing, but I hadn't published anything. I decided to go to journalism school, and I was in Chicago, and I got accepted to Northwestern University, a prestigious, wonderful place to learn about journalism. When I graduated from Northwestern University, my professors there urged me to go into sports writing because they said, you know tennis, and you've got connections in the tennis world, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the tennis world and the crime world are vastly different worlds.
You would think so.
I think that what I was craving was, the grit of the streets. You know, the tennis world was interesting to me, but I wanted something completely different. But the other part of this thing that is fuels my having become a crime reporter is my father did some work with law enforcement in Chicago. This is the 50s and 60s and 70s. He was not a cop, but he managed a hotel that had a relationship with the courts where the people would stay in the hotel immediately after being released from prison. So he carried guns and he did things. So he had that in his background. And I think that's also why I've always been kind of interested in the world of crime and law enforcement.
Just one last question. I mean, our show is called Too Jewish. It's a pretty Jewish book. Tell us about your own Jewish background.
Yes, my own Jewish background. I come from an extremely secularized home. My mother was a member of the American Communist Party, and uh-huh. Was that left-wing secular Judaism.
Sure.
And my interest then in Judaism has deepened as I've gotten older. Now I'm really very fascinated by this idea of what the Jewish diaspora, what is the contribution of American Jews to this evolution of identity politics in this country and just the overall questions that have loomed in the last, 25 or 30 years in this country. I think there's something about the Jewish American experience that is very compelling.
Walter, thank you so much. Where can people go to find out more about you and the meaning of the murder?
Well, I have a website. You should be able to just put in Walter Levis or Walter B. Levis. Either one should bring you to my website. The book should be available everywhere. They're making the book available. I mean, certainly Amazon and all your local bookstores should be able to order it. You know, these days, local brick-and-mortar bookstores don't keep every book on the shelves, but it should be easy to find. Click, click, and you should be able to get it. And my website will also be directing people there.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha. August 3rd, we have a wonderful musical improv night. kosher pastrami, and schmaltz. Our playout on Too Jewish this morning is from cantor David Dudu Fischer, his rendition of Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand lose its cunning. For the coming remembrance of Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, in just a couple of weeks. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona. Tidbak leshoni, oy leshoni.